Welcome to the Anderson Business Advisors Podcast, the nationally recognized preferred provider for asset protection and tax planning in the nation. This show is for investors and business owners looking to save on taxes and build long-term wealth with Toby Mathis, an attorney, author, business owner, and a featured instructor at Anderson's Tax and Asset Protection event held throughout the country. Enjoy the show.
Hey guys, this is Toby Mathis.
And Jeff Webb.
And you're listening to Tax Tuesday. Welcome back to another Tax Tuesday. We're just going to get jumping straight on into this thing since, like always, we have way more questions. Want to make sure we're getting through as many as humanly possible in a reasonable period of time. We always say these are an hour, but I think we did an hour never. So we'll just pretend it's a fictional hour. It's usually about an hour and a half. Send in questions at taxtuesday@andersonadvisors.com. It's where we grab the questions that we answer every other week. We grab them, the ones that are not books. Some of you guys like to really write. But if it's also not too personal, then what we'll do is we'll grab it and we make it one of the questions. If you need a detailed response, you'll need to become a Platinum or Tax client. In other words, if you're asking lots and lots of specific things to you, well, as much as we love you and we'd love to do it for free, we're not a nonprofit. We still have to make a little bit of dollars to keep the lights on. This is fast, fun, and educational. We want you to come back and we want to get back and help educate. So we always want you guys to share with each other and bring it to your friends as well. If you know anybody that maybe they're just tired of getting kicked around from the tax standpoint, or they get run around from their accountants or their attorneys or whoever they're getting tax advice from, maybe the guy down the street, maybe it's a brother-in-law, whatever, bring them all on. It's free and they can get answers and they can verify some things to make sure that you're getting good advice. All right, things that you can do. Here's some freebie. You can always follow us on social media. Go on to YouTube, andersonadvisors.com/YouTube. And and sign up and become part of our community there. Yeah, I think it's called a subscription. So subscribe to our YouTube channel. And make sure there's a little widget next to the subscription button that you click on it. It'll always let you know when we're posting up new content. It doesn't text you or email you and stuff like that. It's when you log on, it'll say, here's the new ones. And that way you can keep up to date on all these wonderful tax law changes. And believe it or not, they're still going to keep making changes because that's what Congress does, is they write laws, rewrite laws. I just wish they wouldn't hire drunk elementary school children with their crayons to write the laws. It would be helpful if they actually...
It's obvious that they're not reading the laws that they're signing in the law. And so I'm not sure who...
Somebody's doing it. It's done in a back room. And again, I think that they have somebody says they hire
it. You're at the mercy of the cheapest intern they have.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, somebody's writing these things. They're just not always checking to see what the ramifications of what they're writing will be and whether it's perhaps inconsistent with some of the provisions, or they'll just get rid of whole provisions and forget that there's a bunch of laws that rely on them. It's always funs, kicks, and giggles. All right. Opening questions. What are the challenges of putting a California property into a Nevada trust? Will you be protected after 2 years? We'll answer that. When is a cost segregation study beneficial to a real estate investor? We will definitely go over that. If I move to a different state of consciousness, right? No, it's a different state. That's what I always think when somebody says, what state should I be in? Conscious? Let's see. Does my LLC need to now be registered in my new home state? Does a home-based business help with lowering taxes, and does it have to be incorporated? Where is the best state to set up an LLC? If I start private lending to individual investors, is it possible to take the 199A deduction? That's the 20% deduction. We'll go over that. What are the tax ramifications or other issues with purchasing my personal property through my corporation? What is the best business setup for a family building or purchasing a multifamily unit, LLC, or C-Corp? We'd certainly answer that. And what's the definition of dealer? And how can I avoid being considered a dealer? What are the ramifications of being a dealer? Well, there's the good, the bad, and the ugly. We'll go over that too. Under our corporation, is it better to lease a vehicle or buy? And last but not least, a question we get quite often is, can I deduct my real estate training costs? Frankly, can I just deduct any training costs, which should just make it real simple, because we will get through it. Questions? All right. Somebody says there's some sound disturbance. We'll see if that keeps going on. There's only one person complaining, so it might be your line. Let's just jump into these. This is always fun stuff. What are the challenges of putting a California property into a Nevada trust, and will you be protected after 2 years? So again, this is a tax course. This is a tax webinar that we're going over Tax Tuesday. But I don't think that you're asking just a tax question. You're not talking about avoiding tax here. You're probably talking about a Nevada Asset Protection Trust. So first thing to know, at any trust, you have three parties, a grantor, trustee, and a beneficiary. And there's two types of trusts, revocable and irrevocable. Revocable trust, the most common example is a living trust. And the irrevocable trust, the most common example is an irrevocable life insurance trust. But I think what they're referring to is Nevada has a statute that's called a spendthrift trust, where if you put an asset into it and you have an existing creditor, that after 2 years, they cannot make claims against that trust anymore. Now, there's some conditions to be met, and you have to be aware that California has its own interests to protect. So whenever you're going across a state line and you're grabbing an asset, California could say, we have a fundamental interest to protect, so we're not going to follow Nevada law. We're just going to ignore it because we have a fundamental state interest that we believe is really important, and we're not going to follow it. So what are the challenges to putting California property into it is, if you want it to be effective, you're going to have to make sure that you understand exactly what it is that you can protect and what you cannot protect. So the first thing is, you want to make sure that if you have a California piece of real estate, it might be wise to get that California real estate into a vehicle and convert it from just real estate into something that is something different, like personal property. And the way you do that is by using an entity. It may actually be a land trust. And then I would more than likely have that land trust have a beneficiary that is in a different state, like Nevada. And Nevada or Wyoming, it really doesn't matter as long as it's not California. And what we've done is we've converted that piece of property from real estate in California to being broken into three pieces. And now you have a grantor, you have the trustee who is on title, and the beneficial use and enjoyment of that piece of real estate is now transferred out of the state. I would then, this is going to sound weird, but when you're dealing with asset protection trusts, you want them to actually be enforceable. So usually we would be stopping there and saying, hey, maybe we'll have a holding company on top. Since you asked about the asset protection trust, we do many a year, and it's usually for your higher end folks. And here's why. It's because you would actually have that LLC partially owned by the Nevada Asset Protection Trust and partially owned by probably your living trust. We wouldn't want you as an individual to own it, just because California would say, great, doing business here for purposes of the franchise tax. They'd want to hit you for that $800 a year. If it's held by a trust, we can get around that, especially if it's a irrevocable trust like a Nevada Asset Protection Trust. So most people are saying, it was my birthday last weekend, so yay, got a little bit older. Now I'm 30 again.
A little older, a little wiser.
I have anniversaries after a certain point. Anniversaries of your 30th birthday is what I like to have. Anyway, let's go back to the asset protection trust. So they're absolutely wonderful vehicles when used correctly. You just want to make sure that a California court can't ignore it. And again, the way you do that is you got to get that real estate in California from you being the true owner of it to something else being the true owner of it. And the only way you're really going to accomplish that with the Nevada Asset Protection Trust is to make sure that the California real estate is owned in a trust, and that trust is owned by an LLC that's out of the state, and that LLC is owned by the Asset Protection Trust. It just sounds weird, and I wish it was easier, but that's really the way that if you want to use this. Now, sometimes it's like bringing a bazooka to a gunfight. The Asset Protection Trust, it's already been determined, you cannot break into those unless when you transferred it, you did something nasty, like you did a fraudulent conveyance, or you were doing bankruptcy planning, or you were transferring, making yourself insolvent, which is why, again, I said the LLC isn't even owned 100% by the Nevada Asset Protection Trust. We'll have you own it, and we'll make sure that the Asset Protection Trust owns it. And the reason you do that is so there's never a question as to whether you were solvent or not. And then it gives us lots of tools if you're ever being attacked. And so if that something happens to that California property, there's not much you can do. They're going to be inside the land trust going after the beneficial interest, which is now inside of an LLC. It's going to be stuck inside that LLC. So they'll get that property. Where this is really potent is if somebody's ever coming after you. And Nevada is one of the only states, if not the only state, actually it is the only state, that alimony is not an exception. So if you have an ex-wife or ex-spouse, ex-husband, whatever, coming after you all the time, asset protection trusts are pretty strong, but just know that you need to make sure that the property is not sitting in your state that they're trying to go after, because that court, you know, whenever you're in court, you're kind of in that judge's forum. They could choose to do some pretty bizarre stuff. You want to make sure that they don't have the ability to undo what you put in place.
So when we're talking about the trustee and the beneficiary, the grantor is obviously the person turning over the property. Mm-hmm. Ideally, do you not have the trustee and the grantor being the same person?
Ideally, I'll tell you what I like to do, and this is going to be some of you guys might not like this answer, but I don't really care what the statutes say. I'll just stick an LLC in there.
Okay.
I don't really want my name sitting on it, or I'll borrow somebody, you know, have an attorney or somebody serving it. Just if I want to make sure my name's not floating around. So let's use the example of I have rabid ex-spouse that likes to sue me all the time and try to get assets. And I don't want them to know what I own, where it is or anything like that. I don't want my name on it. Well, the beneficial interest isn't a public record, so except in Arizona. So if you're anyplace else, then I'm just going to put it in a land trust, and I'll probably use somebody else's name, or I'll use a Wyoming LLC to be the trustee. And the way it works is this. The easiest way to think of a land trust, by the way, this isn't even getting into the asset protection trust, just a land trust in itself, is all we're doing is we're making the legal owner different from the beneficial owner. So the party that gets to occupy it is the beneficial owner. The party that gets to rent it is the beneficial owner. But the party on legal title is a trustee who has no liability for it and really nothing to do with it other than they're holding title. And so this came out of Illinois. So that's what they call Illinois-style trust. There's about 14 states with statutes and the rest of it's common law. But Illinois was great. That's how they bought the Sears Tower. It was, if somebody had known that they were acquiring all these parcels and it was the same party, they would have jacked up the rates or somebody would have tried to block it. And so all they did is made sure that it was a bunch of blind trusts out there with different names on it. And nobody knew that they were acquiring all the properties. So they just, you know, that was it. That's how Disney did Disney World, too. That's how they acquired most of that land. So all it is a fancy way of saying, hey, I don't want everybody to know what I own. If you love people knowing what you own, go for it. Put your name all over it. If you don't think that it's anybody's business, you don't have to have your name on things. Now, there's a ramification. If I'm running a business, it might be tough if my name's not on the business, right? Bankers don't necessarily like it. So you got to be a little careful who you deal with. But for a lot of people, it's worth the little complexity, because if they can't see it, they can't take it.
Right.
And, you know, you're asking for problems if everybody knows what you own. And that's my opinion. That's because I've seen more lawsuits come out of the fact that somebody thinks there's something to get than the reality of it. The reality of it, you know, so I just don't want to tempt that. Somebody says, can I use the setup? Yeah, absolutely. So there's a few other questions. All right, let's keep going after. In that 2 years, by the way, is what the statute says is if you transfer an asset that somebody would have been entitled to an existing creditor. So this is where it really gets interesting. You don't have to wait 2 years. If they're not an existing creditor, then unless it's a fraudulent conveyance, they're not going after anything anyway. So you could set up an asset protection trust in Nevada and it's effective right away. It's just if you have known creditors right now, then they have they only have 2 years to make the claim or 6 months from actual knowledge of the transfer, whichever is later. So if I'm ever worried about it, I'm filing it with the county that I'm transferring an asset into the trust. And that's deemed notice. So then it's just 2 years. But if they're not a creditor of yours, you got immediate protection. So they're pretty potent. And again, we use them with some of the higher end folks. That's not that you shouldn't use it, but hope that helps make sense. From a cost standpoint, by the way, let's go back to that. I mean, from a tax standpoint, these are grantor trusts. There are no tax ramifications. Literally, that structure I just gave you has zero tax returns. So the land trust to the LLC to the asset protection trust, I make the asset protection trust the way I like to do them is as a intentionally defective grantor trust. It's treated as a grantor trust for California purposes. There's no franchise tax on it. And there's no federal tax return due. It just goes under your Schedule E. So that whole structure has zero tax compliance. Just to fill that in for you. Fun question. We love cost segregation. Do you want to jump on this? I don't want to hobart this whole show.
Here's my opinion for the cost segregation. These are almost always beneficial, except what I see in certain cases. If you're going to be selling this property shortly, I see no reason to do a cost segregation on it. All it's going to do is change your gain. You're going to get a deduction now that you're going to be paying back in the next year.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if you are not a real estate professional and you're already incurring losses on your rental properties, this may not be a terrific idea because it's all it's going to do is create passive losses that get suspended while you hold the property. Now, if you're a real estate professional, cost saves are, I believe, are even better ideas because it allows being a real estate professional allows you to take losses that you might not be able to take as just a regular real estate investor.
Yeah.
So that's kind of my two areas of staying away from your rental properties or suffering losses and if you're planning on turning the property over.
Jeff, I feel like geeking out right now. Let's geek out.
Are you going to be an accountant?
Yes. All right. So when you buy real estate, there's really important things. So we have the value of the land or whatever you bought it for. We'll call it, because Jeff's going to use the word basis and stuff. But let's just say you bought it and it was $350,000. Your land value, let's say it was $75,000, which means the improvement value is $275,000. I use $275,000.
I know why you use $275,000. Yeah,
because if it's residential, the IRS has this thing called the, modified accelerated cost recovery system.
Exactly. MACRS.
MACRS. And that means that under the standard, you have 27 and a half years to depreciate this, which means you take 127.5. So you just divide this by 27.5, which means you're taking $10,000 of deduction every year. So if your rents for the year are $10,000, you pay zero tax. That's all. So you're getting, so the IRS basically says, hey, you're going to have to replace that building every 27 and a half years. If this was commercial, it's 39 years.
Yeah.
All a cost segregation is saying, a study is saying is, hey, rather than take it all over 27.5, that's considered 1250 property. 1245 property is everything else. That's personal property.
Yep.
See, we're getting geeky now. You guys are going to learn something. All right. So that personal property, this could be 5-year property, 7-year property. What is the other one?
15.
Anything below 20, and you could do something called bonus depreciation this year, which means you can ignore all these and you can take them all in year one. So what you're doing is you're having somebody break the building down, that 275,000, and they might say, hey, 200 of it is this 1250 property, which gets this 27 and a half. The personal property would be 75,000, which means you can take that in year one. So I'm going to get one, or you take your 200 and you divide it by 27.5, which is going to equal X. You could actually do that. And you're also going to get $75,000 in loss as well. So you're going to get something like, what would that be, about 7,000? 72. Make that. So you're going to get the sum of that as a deduction this year. So that would be 82,000. Is that right? Yeah, whatever it is. 82. No, I just butchered it, didn't I?
No, that's right. 82,272.
All right. So you're going to get an $82,272 deduction. Now, that sounds neat and dandy, but what you're not allowed to take your passive losses and offset your active gains. So there's the passive activity loss rule. So if you have $82,000 of loss, that's yay. Mm-hmm. I'm just carrying that forward. I'm getting really no benefit. So there's really not a big reason to do the cost segregation. But what if I have a bunch of other properties that have positive rents? What if I have $30,000 a year coming in from other properties? Now that $82,000 is my best friend, and it's going to wipe out $30,000 a year until we use it up. It just carries forward.
Right.
Now, the other thing is, what if I am a real estate professional, which means that's how I make my living. One of the spouses needs to spend at least 750 hours in the field of real estate, the buying and selling of real estate, not just being a janitor in a real estate company or whatever, right. You know, so you actually have to be involved in it. And then you have to materially participate in your real estate. That's the trip up, by the way. Over and over and over again, we see people that forget that you have to also materially participate with your properties. You have to do an aggregation election, which you do by filing a notice.
Yeah, it's just an election you file every year combining all your properties.
Is that a special form?
It's an election. It's a statement that goes with the return.
Yeah. So you just have to remember to do it.
Right.
If you don't, you'd be sorry because you're going to that $82,000 could offset your W-2 wages. So if you're a real estate professional and you have one spouse making $500,000 and the other spouse doing nothing, you just lowered your tax bill substantially. You just got an $82,000 deduction. How do you calculate what the cost segregation will be? Do you need to hire a professional?
Yes.
The answer is yes. Yeah. So you could, I could tell you a general rule of thumb is it's going to be somewhere in the 20 to 30% range, depending on the type of property. But you actually have to have somebody go out and do the study. The studies have gotten significantly cheaper over the last few years. There is now software that'll do it for single family residences that runs about $400 per study, but you don't have somebody going through the property. So if you were contested, you may have a little bit of an issue. Is there a place to see an example of a real estate professional statement? So when you are a real estate professional, where are you putting that?
It goes in the return, usually after the return itself.
You just have to keep, all you're doing is you're making an affirmative statement as part of the return. It's not even a form. You're just putting it as a statement.
Right. It's a statement. It's an election that basically says, I am under this IRC code. I'm electing to aggravate all my rental real estate activities.
Hey, Joshua, if you email us at Tax Tuesday at Anderson Advisors, we'll kick you that. We'll just give you what the language is, the magic language. But the language isn't what's important. What's really important is that you actually document your hours. And your hours, it's a two-part test. It's 750 hours plus you have to materially participate with your real estate. So the 750 hours has nothing to do with your real estate. It has to do with you, one of the spouses being in the field of real estate. And it's 750 hours plus, it's the number one use of that spouse's time.
So if you have like four properties and you spend 200 hours on each of them, if you don't aggregate those, then you fail the test on all four properties.
Well, so actually, not necessarily.
Not necessarily.
All right, so let's go through this. So number one, I have to spend 750 hours on real estate, period. And it's only one spouse has to do it. I don't combine time between spouses. So in your example, I had four pieces of property. I spent 200 hours each. I just hit the real estate professional, as long as that's one spouse doing it. Or if you're single, you're doing it. Now we say, all right, you have 800 hours. Is there any other use of your time professionally that exceeded 800 hours? So let's say you're a full-time bookkeeper. You're toast. You're not going to qualify because you spent more than 800 hours. Let's say that you're not. Let's just say you don't do anything else as a profession except you goof off. Then you qualify under the 750 hours. Now we go to second test, material participation. And there's literally three levels of testing. There's 500 hours cumulative, or there's 100 hours and you're the number one provider of time to those properties. So under the example Jeff gave, there was four pieces of property. It's so much easier to say, hey, they're all one enterprise, because otherwise you have to qualify for each property. But under the test, under the facts Jeff gave us, you would qualify for each property. You're over 100 hours. And unless there's a property manager doing more than 200 hours, which I couldn't imagine, then you are materially participating. And to answer your question, Michelle, what does materially participate mean? That's what it means. It's literally, they just say you are doing some activity. You're either managing the manager or you're spending time on those properties. Now, the IRS says it's per property unless you elect to treat them all as one property. So you're making an aggregation election. Please treat all these properties as the exact same thing. So it's actually really potent, but tough to hit. The most extreme example is actually a friend of mine who made about $3 million in his legal profession one year, and his wife qualified as the real estate professional. And he went and he bought so many properties. He had all of his doctor buddies and everything. They were just buying up all these commercial pieces of property, and he was depreciating the heck out of them. His wife qualified as the real estate professional, and he paid no tax. And the IRS did not like that. They came in to audit him, and he's kind of sadistic. So he decided to represent himself because he thought it'd be fun. He's one of those people. And he beat him. He's actually pretty hilarious. So you can actually tell you.
Usually when I see per se on a tax case, I know it's going to end badly.
Yeah. Yeah. For yourself, pro se.
Are you looking to lower your taxes, protect your assets, and grow your wealth? Are you a real estate investor, stock trader, or business owner? If you answered yes, Anderson Advisors Tax and Asset Protection Workshop is for you. Let host Clint Coons, Toby Mathis, and Michael Bowman teach you how to protect and keep more of what you earn. Our workshops are held monthly throughout the country and via live stream. Two in-person tickets to the workshop are only $99. To learn more about the dates and locations, visit AndersonAP.com and register today.
All right. Somebody's asking, let's see, in order to avoid capital gains on a property, who possessed it from probate. Oh, my goodness. Ashvini, I'm just going to make your life muy bien today. So here's a question. This isn't one of the questions that we have, but this is a question you just asked. And the answer is so potent. I just want to, somebody says that was not Scott Estel. No, that was actually an attorney buddy of mine by the name of Howard Spiva. And he'll tell you the story himself, so I'm not preaching anything. He actually sued Savannah into bankruptcy a few years back. If you ever Google him, you know, he's just kind of for kicks and giggles. You can just go in there and Google Howard Spiva. He's a very cool lawyer, and he's been our buddy for about 20 years. He actually represented a gal that had a tree fall on her in Savannah, and Savannah said, "We're not responsible," and he ended up winning, and they didn't have enough. Yeah, Scott is absolutely smart enough to do it. All right, so here go through this thing. So somebody inherits property through a probate, and then how do you avoid the capital gains? Well, here's the beautiful part. When somebody passes, meaning they pass away or they die, all of their assets, their capital assets, step up in value to the fair market value on the date of passing. So if Jeff owns a piece of property and he passes away and gives it to me, thanks, Jeff, I could sell it the next day and pay zero in capital gains because my basis stepped up.
Right.
And that goes for your stock. That it's okay to say die. Yes, you die. So Jeff dies there.
Thanks.
That just sounds vicious. So that's pretty amazing. So it's pretty cool.
Pretty amazing that I died.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing that you don't have to pay tax on it.
Oh, okay.
Now here's the kick. If you're in a community property state and one spouse passes, the entire basis steps up. So if you're ever going to like, hey, I really need to sell a property, I don't want to pay tax, all you got to do is go to the Grand Canyon with your spouse and give them a little nudge over the edge. And the weather, yeah. Like, but the basis stepped up. Thanks. Taking one for the team. All right. So what are the typical percentages of improvement value for the cost segregation personal property for 5, 7, and 15 years? So Julie, it doesn't matter whether it's 5, 7, and 15. We just care that it's less than 20 because the bonus depreciation rules say, yay, we can do it. The typical percentage is right around 20% from what I see. But again, it's going to vary depending on your property and what you have in it. So like if I have a lot of carpeting and I have lots of stuff on the walls and lots of fixtures, and I spend a lot of money I put in a bunch of countertops in and all this stuff, and I spend a lot of money, that means that I'm going to have a whole bunch of value because those items aren't going to make it 27 and a half years. Or if it's in a building, the commercial building, they're not going to make it 39 years. So
now I will say that the bonus depreciation only applies to
year in
18 and 19. You can do cost segs going backwards.
Oh.
And do a change of accounting method.
Yes. So so the bonus depreciation was under the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. Before that, it was 50%.
It was bonus. 50% bonus. Yeah.
And it's going to go back down again. So let's see. If the person sells an inherited piece of real estate for less than the appraised value upon death, can the person take a tax loss?
No.
No. Yeah. So you don't, the basis resets. But I don't think... Would you get a loss on it?
No, you can't take a loss on personal use property. Well, it depends. Okay, we're going to go back to our standard. It depends.
Yeah.
It depends on what you were doing to property. I guess it could be considered an investment property.
Yeah, if it's investment property, then the basis steps up. So don't you start your depreciation and everything else again.
Well, I'm thinking about it, even property you're just holding that you've inherited and you're holding, mm-hmm. waiting to sell it. I don't know if there would be a period you would need to hold it to.
It's interesting. See, Bob, you asked a very interesting question. So if it sells for less than the appraised, they're going to probably, the IRS would argue that the appraised value, we don't really care about. The value is whatever you sold it for.
Right.
But if you held it for a year and this was in 2008, then yeah, there's a chance you'd actually take a loss depending on the type of property. You don't get losses when you sell your house.
Right. You can't take losses on any personal use property.
Right. So it'd have to be investment property. So you'd want to make sure that you have a renter in there. And then I suppose you could. I'm not sure. You know, like, I don't recall any exceptions. Do you recall an exception?
No.
All right. So you got us stumped on that one. We may look at that, maybe email that one on in, because that would be a fun one to do. But I think that you'd actually get the loss. But we email it in, Bob, so we can dig into it, because that sounds like a fun one. On the cost segregation, there's another question. Do you have to be an actual spouse, or can business partners still qualify? Spouses. It has to be one tax return. So you can't do it with daughters and mothers. Oh, and by the way, that material participation, that is cumulative hours between the spouses, by the way.
Right.
So one spouse has to qualify under 750, but both spouses can be added up together to meet the material participation. All right, going back to our questions.
Oh, yeah.
If I move to a different state, does my LLC need to now be registered in my new home state? So the answer is, you know what it's going to be. It's going to depend, right? So we already know. So here's the deal. Your LLC is a separate person. If it has a different home than you, then it doesn't register when you move. So what that means is that it has its own location. This is why when you use Nevada or Wyoming, you actually have to have an office suite. If you live in a state, so let's say that you have a Dairy Queen and you have that Dairy Queen in an LLC and you move, the LLC doesn't have to move with you. Now let's say that you have an LLC and you're selling essential oils out of your house and you have an LLC that only address is your home and you move. Will that need to be registered? More than likely, yes. Now, yeah. Unless you have a place for it to stay, you'd have to have another home for it in your home state. So
yeah, you're going to lose liability protection, aren't you, if you don't move it to your new state?
Yeah, you'd want to make sure that it's there.
I mean, I'm assuming you're doing business out of your new home state.
Right. Somebody says, if I live in Ohio and business is in Ohio, but thinking of moving to Florida, where does it go? You leave it in Ohio. So you could keep your LLC. It doesn't have to go with you. It's separate. It's an artificial person. So you could always leave it in a state. And that, again, that's why you're going to see us use Nevada and Wyoming a lot. And we're not bringing it into your state because we don't want to. We don't want your judges to have any. It's kind of like this. If Jeff lived in California and I lived in Nevada and Jeff gets sued, I don't want it to have anything to do with me. And if I'm Jeff's LLC, it doesn't have anything to do with, like, the judges in California can't do anything with me. But if my bank account is in California, now those judges could do something with it. So I always want to make sure that I keep my LLC that's not my state separate from me and make sure it has its own address, its bank accounts, not in my state and other things. And no judges can touch it. Yeah, and anonymity, we can make it to where they can't see it too. So they don't even know it's there. That's kind of the real secret sauce in my experience in 20 something years of doing this is people can't take what they can't find and they can't see it if it's not in your name. And there's not a real place that they can go to see it. And every year we have somebody saying something about tax returns. I'll just pull your tax returns. And I go, yeah, how's that working for Congress right now? They've been chasing after Trump's. I'm sorry, but yeah, they may be able to get it solely because he's the president, but nobody else. I can't go pull your tax returns for you. So as much as we'd like to, unless you give them to us. And by the way, this is my cue. There's no such thing as a phone call from the IRS to start an inquiry.
Yeah.
It's always a letter. They do not call you and threaten you. If anybody calls and threatens you, this is actually a huge deal. It's costing taxpayers millions of dollars. Hang it up. Block it. And your phones now, especially if it's a cell phone, know enough to, they'll tie it to any other numbers that are used in that group so that you don't get those phone calls. That's not real. It's not real. Hang up and block it. Get rid of it. There's no such thing as the IRS calling and harass you. I get this because the clients call and us up and say, what did you do? The IRS is calling me and telling me I screwed everything up. I'm like, it's not the IRS.
You can always call them. Their number's 800-829-1040. Say, this is me. Do you all send me anything? I'm just verifying. They'd be happy to deal with that.
Yep.
They're having a lot of trouble with identity theft and fraud and stuff. So
it is bad. And if somebody sends you something, don't log into it either. They don't email you as well.
No.
So let's see. Regarding anonymity, couldn't a plaintiff's lawyer use interrogatories to ask for all assets under your control? It depends, Dominic, on whether it has anything to do with your case. So if I am being accused of speeding and running into somebody, what does my financial situation have to do with whether I was negligent when I was driving? The answer is it has nothing to do with it. And I would contest that all day long. So yeah, so they're not going to get to see my financial condition. Usually what you do is you hand them your insurance and say, please read it. And they can't find anything else. They're just going to try to get your insurance and they're going to leave it at that.
Deep pockets.
Yep. And we've seen this over and over and over and over. You always got some lawyer that says, no, I'd get it. Yeah. If you have a rollover, yeah, pushover, sure. But no, our clients, and we're talking about $30 million cases that they've gotten out of, not because they're doing anything wrong, but it's because they're able to settle it for a, you know, without putting all themselves at risk.
Right.
And we got firsthand, yeah, somebody just responded about that. We got firsthand experience with this during that downfall where you had 4 and 5 partners in on properties. And when the property would, if the project failed, they would look for the guy with the money. And our clients were oftentimes the one with the money. And so we got to see how they were able to get out of these things. where there's a $30 million liability that they didn't cause. And they bear no, like, they just happen to be the only one that has anything left when the whole thing blew up. And I'll tell you what, we saw literally a son and his father go through the exact same suit. The son got released after 2 weeks. The dad had to fight it for 2 years. And the only difference between them was the son's assets weren't in the son's name. And the dad was old school and had everything in his name, probably with some lawyer telling him, yeah, you don't need to do that. Well, it cost him millions of dollars. Yeah. So like we saw this over and over. Somebody just says, hey, I got 4 calls from a computer voice, probably a computer this week, saying that they were the IRS or risk going to jail. That is absolutely a scam, guys. Please share that with all your mothers and brothers and sisters and fathers. Anybody, especially old folks. Like, my mom calls me up always freaked out because somebody's calling her, usually with a really horrible accent, saying that she's going to be jailed for something she didn't pay. It's absolutely predatory. Predatory is all get out and then report it. Who you calling old? Hey, stop it. Let's see what else we got. Somebody says, big question. Son and his girlfriend and I plan on using our VA loan to buy properties. One in North Carolina, one in Florida, one in Ohio. Do we file a business name in each state? You file an LLC. Christine, you're going to have those in an LLC in each state. That's what you're going to do. And more than likely, your ownership's going to be through a Wyoming holding company. I would actually talk to us or talk to one of our reps. Somebody says, I keep telling Al not to make those calls. Oh, my goodness. I know who you're talking about. All right. Next one. Does a home-based business help with lowering taxes? And does it have to be incorporated? I'll jump on that. Somebody says, does each LLC need a checking account? It does not. Under that circumstance, it does not. As long as you have a property manager collecting the money and it can forward it to the holding, it is a factor as to whether or not they're going to honor that LLC. In your case, you're not trying to dodge liability. The liability would stay inside that LLC. There's an asset for them to get. So if there was a death on a property or a fire or, you know, horrible environmental claim or something popped up that was, you know, wrong with the property, we keep seeing, if you're on the East Coast, like lead still is an issue. I got to see that firsthand. You just want to have that LLC wrapped around it so that they're stuck in it. That's not going to hurt you. So you don't have to go too crazy on it. You would just have one account where the money would go. All right. Does a home-based business help with lowering taxes, and does it have to be incorporated? Jeff, what do you say?
I'm going to go with the second question first and say, no, it does not have to be incorporated. It can be a Schedule C, preferably through an LLC. It can be an S corporation. Can be a corporation.
But it doesn't have to be any of those.
It doesn't have to be any of those in particular. You kind of want to have the entity that best fits whatever your home-based business is.
Yeah.
Now, as far as does it help lower taxes, hopefully your home-based business is generating tons of income and making you pay more taxes. But I understand what you're saying. You're going to be able to deduct the home office. There's going to be certain other expenses you're going to be able to deduct. Mm-hmm. Your phone lines, your internet, and certain other expenses.
A portion of it. Right. So you're always, by having a home-based business, period, you're going to get to write off things that you're not getting to write off as an individual. So for example, if I am in my house and I am using a room in my house, the IRS gives you a safe harbor of saying, hey, you can write off $5 per square foot per year for your home office, right?
Right.
And that's what they're giving you, and you're done. It's not so great. If you are a little more savvy, I would actually have something that is incorporated from a tax standpoint. So either an LLC tax as an S-corp, LLC tax as a corp, or an S-corp or a corp, and I would have an accountable plan. And I would just go around that rule, and I would just have it reimburse you for your personal use. For the business use of your personal property. And now you're not reporting that anywhere. You're just writing it off on the company. In any case, you're getting to write something off that you wouldn't have otherwise been able to. So it'll absolutely lower your taxes.
Yes.
The big thing for us is, because we look at asset protection and tax kind of on the same level, is if you don't have a box around your business, there's no stopping the liability. And that goes in and out. So if something happens in your business, now they're taking your personal assets. If something happens in your personal life, now they're taking your business. And so we like to see a box put around the business for that reason. So they can't take it away from you. At least you make it very, very difficult for them to take your business away. And on the same token, you're not responsible personally for anything that happens in the business. And yeah, there's a bunch of tax reasons you do that. It'll absolutely lower your taxes. Our average, and we're trying to get the exact number, but it's between $20,000 and $30,000 of extra deductions per year. I think that's what we were looking at.
Right.
I know we're trying to grab a bunch of returns and give you the actual calculation, but just by incorporating, if you have that much revenue, then it's a good chance that that'll go away. And what's that worth to you? It depends on what your tax bracket is. If that's the only money you have coming in, not that great. If it's additional money on top of a high-paying job, then it's fantastic. So it always depends on your situation.
And here's the difference between having an S corporation and a Schedule C is if you're not profitable in your Schedule C, then that home office deduction is suspended until you're profitable. If you're reimbursing that expense through an S corporation,
you can actually create
it's a deduction. Yeah, it creates a loss.
Yeah. And a lot of people, like, again, accountable plans, that's when the business is reimbursing the business use of personal assets. They only exist for you, the owner, in S-corps and C-corps. You can't do that out of a sole proprietorship or out of a partnership. So that's just life, unfortunately. Yeah. So the answer to your question is, yes, home-based business absolutely will lower your taxes, and it does not have to be incorporated. Although we strongly suggest that you look at that because it's better for tax and better for asset protection. And just to throw it in there for estate planning, because you can't give away something that's you. If you pass and you're sole proprietor, so did your business. Whereas if you have an LLC or something, then it's separate than you and they can be perpetual. Can I change my LLC taxes from one year to the next? You can, subject to certain limitations, but absolutely. Somebody else is asking, can I own an Arizona property and a Florida LLC? You can, but you may be registering that Florida LLC in Arizona. Usually what we would do there is have a land trust and have the beneficial interest held by the out-of-state LLC. Let's see, currently living and having an LLC in California. I have a bank and credit card attached to it. Can I run the C Corp and holding in Wyoming? Of course, absolutely, you can. Just know that California likes to try to bring in anything. If you ever ask them, hey, do I have to pay taxes here, the franchise tax? The answer is always yes.
Mm-hmm.
What if it's I wouldn't go down. I have some bad examples, but their answer is yes, pay us money every single time. That freaks people out. Can an LLC be recategorized from a sole prop to a C or S Corp in mid-year?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. We'll just leave it with a guess.
Yes, you can. Yeah, but you have to follow the rules. So an S-Corp, if it's an LLC that's disregarded, then you would just wouldn't you just file a 2553? Couldn't you do it at the end of the year and just say this?
Yeah, if it's an LLC, you just file a 2553. You don't have to do the check the box form.
Yeah, the other one, you're doing an 8832 as a C-Corp.
Yeah.
And you may be getting a different EIN, right?
Right.
Where is the best state to set up an LLC? So
does it depend?
It's going to depend. Absolutely. Hey, somebody's in Bogota. Hey, yes. That's so cool. Ted in Bogota now. Sweet. That's where my wife's from. So anytime I see Bogota, I think, I don't know, everything is depends. Yeah. That's what everybody says, right? So where's the best state to set up an LLC? So if you are an active business, then you're going to have to be registered in your home state.
Yep.
So then I look at the inside liability and outside liability in that state. And I say, hey, could we be an LLC in that home state? And will that get us where we need to go? So you could actually set up an LLC in your home state and have it owned by an out-of-state LLC. So if we're looking at isolating the liability of the business in an LLC, it doesn't really matter. We'll have it in our home state. If we're trying to keep somebody from being able to take that LLC away from you, we're probably using Wyoming. Be straight with you. Nobody can take it away. So that's the truth. You guys are being mean to me today. This is horrible.
Hey, he just had a birthday. Give the guy a break.
Yeah, I'm getting older. I'm getting a little cankerous. I'm being like Jeff. People are ganging up on us here.
Walter.
Yeah. Here's the other one is if you have a business that has other partners in it, then those partners, especially if you have an angel investor, they're going to want you to be in Delaware because they're self-serving. They want to be able to take that business from you. They also want to use what's called an objective standard of care. They want you to have to be a reasonable business owner. Yeah, whereas if you go to Wyoming or Nevada, it's a subjective standard of care, and I can pretty much do whatever I think and I don't have to worry about getting sued by these guys. So like you'll see this. And if you've ever done a commercial loan, you will find yourself having to go to Delaware more than likely. And what they'll oftentimes do is they'll have, the real reason I know this because I've done a bunch of these, is they'll have a holding company that is going to own the entity that's getting the loan. And that holding entity will be in Delaware. It'll be the sole owner of the entity that's actually going to hold the real estate. It's a very interesting setup. And what they're doing is they're making sure that they can pierce through and take that company away from you in the event you don't pay. That's if you're dealing with commercial lenders, and that's what you're probably going to be doing. And then you would have the actual property held in an LLC in that state. If you do not need to do that, if you don't have an angel investor or a hard money investor, or actually hard monies don't really care, but if you're not doing a commercial loan, so I'm not doing asset-based lending, then more than likely, I'm going to have your state LLC be wherever the real estate is or wherever the active business is, but I'm probably going to have it held in a Wyoming entity at some point. And the reason being is that in Wyoming, the maximum, the only thing that they're allowed to get under law is a lien against your LLC. They can't take it away from you, with the exception is if you're doing fraud or criminal activity. But if you're doing your best and you're being an honest person, they can't take it away. And what it does is it forces a early settlement because their win is a lien. It's all they can get. They don't get any money. So you think about yourself. You're going to sue somebody, and your win is basically to put a lien on their business that they still run. You're not even in control. You have no say in it whatsoever. There's some really good questions people seem. What if you're doing an online business like an app? Does the LLC need to be in your home state? The answer is no. If you're doing interstate commerce only, then you can have it be in a Wyoming or Delaware or Nevada. Is equity stripping a necessity in real estate asset protection? So equity stripping, Jack, that's a great question. I think it's one of the best things you could do is whenever. So let's just go back to this idea of inside and outside liability. And pardon my drawing. Oops, this is not drawing. I have to actually get my pen. So let's say, and I'm just grabbing a better ink color than red. Let's say that I have a piece of real estate. So here's my real estate and here's my LLC. If I have a fire or something happens to this piece of real estate, I want to remain in there. What they can get is the equity in that real estate. So if I own this piece of real estate and it's $200,000 and I own it for cash, they're going to get my $200,000. Pretend that says $200,000. So they would get whatever the equity is. Here's another way. If I don't want to have equity in there, chances of them really pursuing it super aggressively are reduced. So I may have an entity out here, my little lending entity, loan it money and take back and have a deed of trust or a lien against that property. And that's called equity stripping. You can use a bank. You could use your own entity. You could use a buddy's entity. You could use your buddy's IRA and, you know, pay him a little interest or whatever. But all you're trying to do is say, hey, rather than have $200,000, maybe I take $160,000 on a loan, $160,000. Now my exposure is the $40,000 of equity. And what that does is I happen to know that the average cost of a foreclosure is right around 40 grand. Tells them that if they win, they're going to get nothing. So the chances of them pursuing you aggressively for $40,000 are greatly diminished. You're probably settling that thing for $10,000. And it's not trying to get out of things that you owe or, you know, escape liability. It's forcing, you know, the frivolous cases to go away. The legitimate cases hopefully have decent insurance. And if the insurance company has been goobers and they're not paying for something, it doesn't put you in the shooting, you know, in the crosshairs. They'll probably be kicking something out to make it go away as well. But in any event, you're limited on what your total loss could be. And now it went down from 200 to 40,000. So, and somebody says, if you already have solid asset protection set up with regards to rentals, do you still need landlord insurance? Absolutely, positively. There's a huge difference, Elijah, between a regular personal property and a D3 and some of these others. You want to make sure that you have landlord insurance as well. And you want to make sure that your tenants are carrying renter's insurance and that they're making that the primary. And then this is, unfortunately, not in this day and age, make sure you have umbrella insurance as well. It's really good lawsuit protection because even if your landlord says, nope, we're not going to cover you, well, the secondary insurance will come in and at least cover the lawyers so that you can negotiate this thing and get rid of it. What happens if there is a lien against your LLC in the example and you're selling the property you get a payoff. So in my example, I'll go back to it. Let's say there's a deed of trust for $160,000. And you go to sell it. When you sell it for $200,000, the deed of trust gets paid off. So you'd get the cash up here if it's you. If it's a bank, they get paid back, just like anything else. Let's see. What is the beneficial to put your name on the title or people's property? If total is five property, do you use five LLC name or just one LLC? I'm not certain I understand the question, but I think you're saying, hey, if you're using land trust, use an LLC and you can use one. Does the SBA put any special requirements on an entity setup? Of course they do. They want you to be a personal guarantor and they want there to be one entity holding the asset so that they know that they can get it and there's not anybody else making a claim against that asset because that might be how they get paid. I've negotiated many an SBA loan when the crisis hit here in Vegas. I got way too involved in a whole bunch of SBA loans on clients where their businesses were failing or their bank pulled their lines of credit. And all of a sudden you just had one here, a huge restaurant. And it seems like everybody was doing their best job to put them out of business. It was like, are you kidding me? Like these banks were just being goobers and you had all this stuff going on. So yeah, the SBA was actually the easiest company to deal with or the easiest organization to deal with. And, you know, nobody's really in the business. They really don't want the assets back. I mean, no bank is in the business of running your business. They just want to know that they're secured. So, all right. So going back to the same example, we'll get back to this stuff, guys. We'll go through all these questions. Somebody is asking, are you saying the outside entity borrows $160,000? No, this guy is loaning it. So this guy is loaning the money down here. So this guy is loaning. So the money is going this way to buy the property. And that's the lien. So that's a deed against that guy. So I meant if there is a non-friendly judgment and they can't take our LLC, what happens when you're selling the property held in the name of the LLC and it comes to the title search? Nothing. You know, it's just that. So if you sell this property, hey, I sell this property inside the LLC, nothing. LLC owns it. Yeah, nobody can come outside and take it. So if you're out here, so let's say I'm out here, here's Toby smiling. Who owns that property? The LLC does. This little LLC down here owns it. So if they ever come after me, then they have to try to go get here and there's not much equity. Now I know what you're saying. If somebody's going after me and you sell the asset inside it, well, you're still getting $160,000 up here. Problem is if you own that one too, you better hope that is in Wyoming. Because you don't want it to be able to take it. All right, so we have a whole bunch of more questions to go through. If I start private lending to individual investors, is it possible to take the 199A deduction? Jeff, what do you say?
Well, the answer is kind of, sort of, yes.
kind of, sort of?
Maybe. We're still not sure about this. We're pretty sure that individual private lenders are not going to be able to take the 199A. They're considering whether like hedge funds or private equity funds may be able to take them because they're usually considered trader businesses in themselves.
Yeah.
But for an individual doing private lending, you're probably going to be considered what's called a specified service. Yeah.
Yeah. So here's where it gets fun. So Clayton says, what is a 199A deduction? 199A deduction is a fancy way of saying the 20% deduction on qualified business. And so I'm going to unpack this for you real quick. So 199A equals 20% deduction versus QBI. There's a few other tests, and some of you guys that are savvy on this stuff knows that there's some other things you have to meet. But it just means that if I make $10,000, I only have to pay tax on $8,000. Or if I make $100,000, I only have to pay tax on $80,000. So it's a nice big deduction. It's what they gave the pass-through businesses when they gave the C-Corps that 21% flat tax rate. So it's pretty potent. Now, here's the thing. You have to go to QBI and say what qualifies as qualified business income. It's trader business income. And then you have to look and say, what is not considered trader business income? Well, first off, wages are not considered trader business income. Capital gains are not considered trader business income. Interest is not considered trader business income. So now I look at it and say, hey, wait a second. I am doing private lending. Does that even fall underneath the category of QBI? And the answer is no, unless it's your business, in which case, now we're going to say, do you meet the definition of a dealer? You're buying it to sell it. And if I'm buying notes and selling notes, then I might qualify. But if I'm just writing notes, probably not. Then we look at it and say, all right, maybe you're rising to the level of a trader business where that's really what you do is you're just doing a whole bunch of lending. And I don't know the threshold, guys. Nobody does. But let's just say that that's what you're doing in this business. Now you're going to fall into an exception, what they call the specified service business, where it's in finance or brokerage, if you're brokering loans especially. In which case, you're going to phase out if you make over $157,000 as an individual or $315,000 if you're married filing jointly. You're going to lose this deduction. So to say the least, it's complicated. To reiterate what Jeff said, is really what he's trying to do. He doesn't want to say it depends just because he doesn't want to have people make fun of him, but it depends. So if you're lending to individual investors, my position would be that that's interest income and it's passive if you're doing anything else. So if you're primarily a gap lender, would you be eligible? Probably not. If you are doing other activities, then the answer is a big fat maybe. And what I would be doing is saying, hey, you know, maybe I should just try to make sure I don't have any of that income. Maybe I'm paying it up to a corporation. Maybe I have an LLC that's doing the lending. Or better yet, you have the lending going to a corporation. And that way the corporation has less exposure. It's like it's keeping the exposure off of you and you're just getting interest income that's not subject to Social Security taxes. So yeah, I would take that too. And all of that stuff. There's another one. When I borrow money to an LLC from a private investor, so I think I'm borrowing money from the LLC and the LLC sends them a 1099 for the interest they made. Is there any other paperwork I have to do from the IRS? I think, wouldn't that be a 1098 or is that a 1099?
No, the 1099 would be fine.
INT.
Yeah.
Yep. Then you'd be good. What about lending through an IRA? Then you don't have to worry about the 199A deduction because it's not a trader business. Lending from an IRA is fantastic.
And you don't have to do a 1099.
Yeah, because it's not taxable.
Yay.
All right. We like it. So if you have an IRA, you should really consider lending to people that you know that aren't related to you. That's called a gift. It's not a loan when it's to family members.
You ain't ever seen that money again.
Attention all real estate investors, business owners, stock traders, and anyone looking to get out of the rat race for good. We all know time is money, but did you know there's a wealth of resources on how to make more money, keep more money, and protect what you've earned all for free online? Anderson Business Advisors YouTube channel offers free resources on asset protection and tax reduction from lawyers and CPAs designed to help you keep more money in your pocket. To learn how to limit your liability, protect what you've earned, and minimize your tax burden all for free, subscribe to Anderson Business Advisors on YouTube today.
All right. What are the tax ramifications or other issues with purchasing my personal property through my corporation? So this is an interesting one. And that's because it doesn't make any sense if they're buying personal property through a business, right? But you can hammer this one.
So if we're talking personal property, meaning property that is personal to you, don't do it through the corporation, please.
Mm-hmm.
If you're talking personal property as intangible personal property, like equipment, which is what I consider personal property.
Here's the thing. They said my. Whenever you say my, that implies that you're using it personally. When you say personal property, then I'm thinking that you're using it personal. And you're just buying it through the corporation, what's the tax ramification? If you don't have an exclusion for it, like it's not something that's being used by the business and it's just buying it, then that's considered wages.
Yeah.
So
if you're buying your personal residence through your corporation, please don't do that.
If I buy you a car and I give you a car, that's wages. If I buy a car in the corp and it's, even if it's 50% used by the business and I can write it off through the business, whatever portion that I'm using is still taxable to me as wages. Right. And they use the lease value. They put a new schedule out every year and nobody does that. And they roast people on it. So it's like, you see 100% business usage by the family car.
Yeah. For example, we did have a doctor who bought cars for everybody on his staff.
Yeah.
And we had to compute.
That's wages.
We had to compute every year what the personal use was so they could put it on their W-2s.
Yep. Yep. All right. So tax ramifications. Well, what if it's like a computer or your phone or other things? Then the company can write it off and you don't have to.
Yeah, I think if the corporation's buying you a cell phone because you're required to have a cell phone for your corporate job, I think that's a legitimate expense.
Absolutely.
It's got to have a business use.
Absolutely. All right, sweet. What is the best business setup for a family building or purchasing a multifamily unit, LLC or C Corp? I'll be really easy on this. All right. If you are buying a property that you are going to sell immediately, then you are a dealer. Then you could go ahead and use a C Corp or an S Corp, probably an S Corp. An LLC is not a tax designation. An LLC is only for state. So it depends on how we would have it taxed. But if I was flipping a property, then I could have an LLC taxed as a C Corp and an LLC taxed as an S Corp. So LLC or C Corp, It would not matter if I am a dealer. If I am buying a building and what or I'm at multifamily and I plan on renting it out and I'm keeping it, then I am not doing a C corp because there's adverse tax consequences to having appreciating assets in a C corp. If I ever take it out, it's going to nail me as wages, the whole appreciated value of the business. And that goes for an S or a C corp. If I am an LLC, I could be taxed as a disregarded or as a partnership. That's fine for a family building. So if I'm buying like a building that I'm going to lease to my business, or hey, I want to have an apartment unit or an eightplex, it's going to be an LLC taxed as either a disregarded entity, which means it goes right under my Schedule E, or as a partnership. In either case, it's going to flow through to me. I'm not going to have it being taxed as a corporation.
No. Got to have that LLC though.
Yeah. No bueno. Let's see. If I'm buying a duplex and living in half, so you're house hacking. AJ, I know what you're doing, right? Half and renting half. Should I purchase or hold the home under an LLC, my current C corp, or just under me personally? So AJ, it's kind of funky. If it's me and I have a tenant in that house, I'm isolating my liability. I'm putting in an LLC, but I'm making a disregarded LLC. And the reason I do that is because half of that property is my personal home, my personal residence, and I qualify for something called a 121 exclusion. The 121 exclusion is when I can sell a house and not pay capital gains if I lived in it as my primary residence for two of the last 5 years. If I'm single, it's $250,000. If I'm married, it's $500,000. So I want to make sure that I don't ruin that. I'm not going to use an LLC, or excuse me, I'm not going to use a C corp, but it's going to be an LLC. I wouldn't do this just as me personally, because there's no stopping the liability. If somebody falls down the building or the steps on their half of the building and sues me for something, says I was negligent or whatever, there's literally no cap on the amount of damages I could get hit with. And they could follow me around the rest of my life. So I don't want that. So I want to be able to cut it. Right? I mean, I guess I could go bankrupt at some point, but it depends on what you nail for. Now you're talking to a guy that I actually, on behalf of a client, garnished a tenant in a piece of property for over 11 years at her job. Like, you can, just because somebody says, oh, I just go bankrupt. Well, she tried to. There's exceptions under the bankruptcy code too. So there's a good chance that you don't even get to bankrupt away the liability. Anybody says differently doesn't know the exceptions.
So even though the duplex is one undividable property,
mm-hmm.
you're still putting that rental portion in that LLC.
I'm putting the whole thing in the LLC.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I won't be able to stop them from getting my half. I still have a homestead.
Okay.
In many states, I guess I should say, in some you'd lose it. Again, Texas and Florida, where they have unlimited homestead, it kind of stinks, but there's nothing you can do about it. You have a home property that's an undivisible piece of property that is both personal use and investment use. So you ruined your homestead anyway. Like, the way I look at it is, I would just be putting that in LLC. It's more important to me that I don't lose my rest of my assets that I have, and I don't subject myself to adverse tax consequences. Those are the big things for me. So somebody says, any ways to minimize the franchise fee for multiple LLCs in California? Yeah, you could have a local property management company. You have a single holding entity out of the state. That holding entity really should be held by a trust, so you're not bringing it right back into California. And then you would make sure that the California properties are held in individual land trusts, and either with LLCs out of the state or something along those lines. So that's how you do that, Daniel. Now, if you ask the franchise tax board, they're going to say, great, pay us $800 on every LLC you have that's not nailed down. So you want to make sure that you don't own it, that it's a trust that owns the LLC, and that LLC is the one that owns the other LLCs. You want to try to keep yourself twice removed. What we oftentimes do is we put different trusts between each layer. So you may have a personal property trust owning the interests in the various LLCs. And again, all we're trying to do is get out ahead of this thing. We actually won that on an audit. We had two highway patrol people that won against the franchise tax board simply because they didn't own it. It was their living trust that owned the LLC. You know, how often does that happen? Well, we don't get audited. We try not to allow that to occur, but if it does, it's nice to have your argument.
Right.
Oh boy, dealer stuff. What's the definition of dealer, and how can I avoid being considered a dealer? What are the ramifications of being a dealer? You want to hit this one?
Well, a dealer depends on what your intent was when you purchased the property.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were intending to sell this property when you purchased the property, you're going to be classified as a dealer.
Yeah, dealer is buying something to sell it.
Right.
An investor buys it to hold it and make long-term appreciation and rents.
Now, the consequences of this is the income is considered ordinary income, not capital gain income when you're a dealer. And I think there's some danger that if you have other sales of property, they may consider all of them.
Yeah,
dealer transactions.
Yeah, so there's one of the Journal of Accountants, he's had a pretty nasty case where a gal developed some properties, and once she was a developer, a dealer and a developer are considered the same thing from a tax standpoint. Their tax is ordinary income, and they reclassified everything she had, saying, oh, it's all part of one enterprise, which is really bad because you lose long-term capital gains. Everything is active ordinary income, meaning that it's subject to self-employment tax. You lose the ability to do installment sales.
Correct.
You lose the ability to do 1031.
Well, let's go back. You can do an installment sale, but you still have to recognize all the income now, which makes it really bad.
All right, I'll rephrase that. You lose the benefits, the tax benefits of an installment sale. And you can't 1031 exchange.
Right.
So you lose a lot of the benefits of a dealer, and you can't depreciate. So you lose your depreciation, you lose your 1031 exchange, you lose your long-term capital gains. So, and you lose installment sale benefits. So what are the ramifications of being a dealer? It's pretty miserable if you get caught doing this. And as for the time frame, anybody who tells you that hey, you hold the property longer than a year, you're not a dealer, hasn't read their cases. There's cases where people have held the same property for 10 years and are still considered a dealer. They look at your intent when you bought it. If they can see your intent when you bought it, that's what you are. So if you bought it to sell it, even if you didn't sell it, but they could see that that's what you've been trying to do the whole time, you're just waiting for the opportunity to get out of that thing, you're a dealer. If you fix and flip, you're definitely a dealer.
Yeah. So if you look at previous cases to determine the holding period, what the president basically says is it's going to depend on that person sitting on that bench.
Yeah. Right. Somebody says, I think it's going back one. If you have the property deeded in an LLC for liability purposes while using it as a personal residence, do you have to do that for the personal residence exception? No. So that what they do is they ignore that LLC. Usually when we're doing the LLC, we're filing it as disregarded, so you don't have to worry. If you sell your home and get more than owed on the mortgage, is that capital gains tax? No. So capital gains is your basis minus what you sold it for.
So let's give you a really ugly scenario.
Mm-hmm.
Your cost in a property is $100,000, but over the years you've refinanced and the loan amounts have gone up. You now owe $400,000 on this house that you sell for $500,000.
Mm-hmm.
So under the loan scenario, you would think your gain was only $100,000. But when in fact, your gain is $400,000.
Plus, you have to recapture the depreciation you took. So
how
many years did you hold it for?
Oh, let's say 10 years.
10 years? Oh, man.
Let's make it 9 years. So a third of the value.
A third of the value. Well, whatever the improved value.
About $170,000.
So if it's $100,000 and your land value is 30, then you'd have 70 and you'd take a third of that is probably what you wrote off.
Yeah. So we sometimes see this on sales of property, especially if it's residences and all that people have borrowed against their home and what they get out of the proceeds of a sale after paying off their debt is way less than the gain on sale.
And you're like a lot of people. You think, oh, shoot, but I didn't get any of the money. Gave it all to the lender. Doesn't matter. You got that money at some point. So you'd still want to 1031 exchange that. And you'd want to get another loan. You kind of have to, right? Or you have to buy equal or greater value, regardless of the debt, right? Under our corporation, is it better to lease a vehicle or buy? So we get this question quite often. And the answer is always going to be, depending on what you're buying, like how much is going to be used by the business. Then I'm always going to say you're better off to not own it in the corporation.
Okay.
Nine times out of 10. There's people that think you're a goober for doing that. But the ramifications of doing this wrong are so draconian that I just rather do mile IQ and reimburse myself and not have to think about it. Pay less in insurance and it's my car and I don't have to worry about which car it is at the vehicle, all my mileage logs. I just have one app on my phone. But if I am a corporation, which one's better? You're writing both off. Like it depends on whether you have a bunch of income. If you're making a whole bunch of money, then I might buy a vehicle. If I'm not, then I'm probably leasing it.
Well, let me throw this in. Let's say you're buying an expensive car, not an SUV or a van or a truck, but an expensive car. Say your company needs a Corvette.
Mm-hmm.
your depreciation deduction is going to be limited to, what is it this year, around 20,000, the depreciation?
It's like 16.
16. If you lease the vehicle, you're going to get a much higher deduction over time. I don't know if a lot of companies lease vehicles to small corporations.
You're going to be a personal guarantor on it no matter what. They will. Somebody said, going back to the previous questions, I was told by my accountant that in order to claim a personal residence exception, you must hold it in your name, not an LLC. So that's just an accountant not knowing the tax laws, you know. But if you're worried, you just put it in a land trust, and that way they don't have to know that there's an LLC involved. But the LLC is disregarded for tax purposes, period. So if you're owning it and it's you, not you and a spouse in a separate property state, but it's you or you and a spouse in a community property state, then there's not even a tax form. Nobody even knows. So, you know, and again, I'm pretty sure that the code has that specific provision. I know for a living trust,
it does. I know it has for the living trust.
Yeah, but I'm 99% certain. I know what the IRS says too. It's like, hey, it's disregard for tax purposes. Therefore, you still get your personal exemption as long as you're a personal residence. All right. Can I deduct my real estate training costs? This is the last question we have today. Can I deduct my personal training costs? Yes. The question is, can I write them off right now? Do I have to spread them out over a number of years? Can I write them off personally, or do I need to put them inside of a corporation? And the answer, Jeff, you like doing this stuff, is it's always going to be fact specific, but
yeah, because I know it's good. We're going to say it depends, but it's going to depend on where you want to deduct these and how it relates to the business that you're currently in. So I'm going to disregard the real estate portion and just say training costs by itself, because we do have this. We sometimes have the personal training and the mentorship and coaching. Mm-hmm. So if this is an existing business that's doing business,
easy.
It's easy. And it's, we're assuming the training relates to the business that you're in. It's a deduction. If it's a Schedule C and it's a new Schedule C business, no, you're probably not going to be able to deduct the real estate training. Say you're flipping in a Schedule C, which we don't really advise. But if it's a corporation and you're flipping, we go back to that depends on when the actual training took place and when the corporation reimbursed you for those training costs. So any real estate training that took place before incorporating, you're probably going to have to amortize those costs over 15 years. Mm-hmm. Any of those trainings that were reimbursed back to you after you incorporated, we're assuming that you are in business and those are training costs for your business.
Yeah, it gets complicated.
It gets complicated.
If you already have real estate, it's easy. If you don't have any real estate, then you'd better make sure you're incorporating. That's what it really boils down to. And then when you actually go through the training or mentorships or other, will dictate whether or not it's something that's a startup cost or whether it's an ordinary necessary expense while your business is going on,
right,
that you're just reimbursing. If it's before your business, doesn't it count as a startup? The answer is yes, unless you haven't done it. So let's give you an example. So let's say there's this guy, Jeff, who goes through a real estate training and mentorship, and he hires a coach. And so he pays $20,000 for coaching, and that's really his real estate training costs. And his coaching is going to be for the next 6 months, and he incorporates. That's not a startup expense. His corporation is now in existence. He hasn't done any of the coaching. The coaching all goes to the benefit of the corporation. That's an ordinary necessary expense. Even though Jeff individually had purchased it before, he transferred over to the corp. Corp got the benefit. Corp doesn't have to worry about a startup expense. Now flip that around. Jeff does $20,000 of coaching, sets up his business, says, hey, I really like this. I'm going to really make it work now. That's a startup expense. And that startup expense, still deductible, but you're only able to write off $5,000 in the first year. You're taking the remaining $15,000 and you're spreading it out over 15 years. So you're taking $1,000 a year for the next 15 years.
Right.
So you don't lose it. You're just spreading it out. So it's obviously better to, if you can, to make sure you're in business. And it's a lot more fun. Here we go. We got a bunch of questions that came in. By the way, so I paid for a live stream and I'm a full-time real estate investor. What type of expense is that? I would put down there as continuing education.
Yep.
And depending on your licensing, you actually get credit for that. Is a disregarded LLC simply an LLC with one member? Not necessarily. The IRS looks at it and says, yeah, it's one member, but it could be a husband and wife in a community property state. They're considered one member. And it's just disregarded. We just ignore it for tax purposes. So it flows right down to the owner. If it's before the business, does that count as a startup? Again, it kind of depends. If I owned a nonprofit and put a property in the nonprofit, can it charge rent? Yes, of course. So the nonprofit, let's say that I donate a piece of property to my nonprofit. I get to write off the value of that piece of property.
Yes.
If I've owned it over a year, it's the fair market value. If it's less than a year, then it's my basis. And in either case, I'm going to be limited to 30% of my adjusted gross income for the deduction, and I can carry forward the additional for 5 more years. But that nonprofit now can rent it. Yeah, it generates income with it. Do you have to be taxed as a C-Corp to get the benefits of education costs? Not necessarily. An S-Corp could do it too. A C-Corp locks it in stone. If you're an S-Corp, then I guess there's a little bit of a worry that it's not in the business unless it's actually right. Owns the real estate too. So it's much cleaner if you do a C-Corp, but I don't want to say that it's just for a C-Corp. Are ABA workshops considered continuing education expenses? Yes. A lot of them are actually qualified for continuing real estate education, depending on your state. A lot of them get your continuing legal education, and some of them even get the continuing accounting. What do they call that?
Continuing professional education.
Yeah. So you check with your state, and then we have a member of our staff that can help you with that. Valerie, that's what she kind of works on. So we've gotten some, the 3 days, I forget how many hours those things, it was like 20 hours or some ridiculous amount. I know because we get them for teaching them. So, all right, let's keep going through TaxWise workshop. And we're getting pretty close to an hour and a half, so I want to start to wind this thing down. June 13th and 14th, so this week we have next TaxWise workshop. If you want to attend that live stream, we don't have any more room in our office. So it's AndersonAdvisors.com, 3-for-1. You can get the live stream for $197, plus you'd get access to the recording from January, and you'd get the live stream for November, and you'll get recordings on all three. It's just basically hey, you get all the TaxWise for the entire year. I go over about 30 different tax deductions. I change it up every event just to keep it interesting, and because we're focusing on different things, beginning of the year versus end of the year, planning is a little different. So you can do that.
So we got a live workshop coming up on Thursday and Friday of this week.
Yep, this June 13th, 14th, right there. You could do the live stream. There's not going to be ability to come live, but you can stream it, which means you can sit there and watch it. And you'll get the recording.
And be that much smarter than everybody else.
Hey, it only takes one, you know. Yeah. See, I get the benefit. I get the emails afterwards. What's always fun is you'll have one strategy. And I tell people to try to learn three every time they go through. Just find three that you're going to apply. Like, you don't need to know them all and do nothing. You need to know one and actually do it, and you're much better off. So you find three that pique your interest, and those are the three. You could have one. So I had one couple that ended up with $170,000 deduction that they wouldn't have had otherwise, offsetting some pretty sizable income. So the benefit of the class, just one of them, they were kind of chuckling about it, was about $80,000 in their pocket. And that's not completely uncommon.
Yeah, unfortunately, there's not usually room for me to send my tax people, but I do have them listen to the tax lies.
Yeah, it's fun stuff.
It's stuff to sharpen your skills, even for us tax people.
If you can't tell, there's a lot that changes. And, you know, it's one of those things where you get different, like there's constantly of things being put out there in the tax world. They have regulations being entered. You have things being phased out, phased in. And then, of course, Congress likes to change the laws. You kind of just have to keep your finger on that pulse. Otherwise, you risk losing a ton, because usually they will pull things to where you think that you've got it under A, they'll make it into B, and B has an adverse consequence to you. So you just want to kind of just keep your nose to the tax grindstone a little bit. You don't have to know it all, but you're just listening for things that are relevant to you.
Right.
iTunes, you can go in and listen to our podcast. You're going to see a whole bunch of Tax Tuesdays. Jeff and I do these every other week, so you can always come in and check with the Tax Tuesday. But you can get the podcast with iTunes, and I do a bunch of other, myself and Clint, and sometimes Michael Bowman and other folks do interviews with folks. So, for example, residential assisted living, everything from cost segregation, qualified opportunity zones, insurance. We grab people that we work with or that we know or that are experts in the field and have them enlighten us on certain rules and how people use these things. You can do the same thing on Google Play. Just because you guys have been so good, I'm going to throw this one at you. If you like really thought out, kind of like basic how to compute and actually make money without getting reamed and without spending obscene amounts of money to make mistakes, then do the Infinity Investing Workshop. You go there to the infinityinvestingworkshop.com, the sign up there, and that little code there gets you everything for free. There's 11-part series plus 4-part bonus series on everything from financial stewardship to how to, you know, to how to create an infinity investing income stream. So it's kind of fun. And you can use that little free tax. If you're super, super smart and you're really good at making money and you already know how passive income works, then don't do it for yourself. But if you know of anybody that's kind of tired of, they seem like they're running is so fast and they can't get ahead, they're probably trying to build the wrong type of income and they're being sold liabilities in the guise that it's actually an asset. Go through this, share this with them so that they don't make those mistakes. And you'll see that it's pretty easy, pretty fun. And you'll learn how to make some money on some things you probably didn't realize you can make money at. Replays of this Tax Tuesday, you can always go to your Platinum portal and you can see it in there. And of course, you'll get a link to this one if you registered for the event. Feel free to share it to anybody. We don't charge for these things. All it is getting the information out there. Helps everybody. And then please follow us on YouTube and Facebook. And if you're willing to, please rate what you see and hear. We're big education junkies, and we believe that you should, you know, teach the topics that you're constantly working with. It keeps you sharp. If you can't tell, Jeff and I sit here, and between us, we have, I mean, quite literally many, many decades of experience, and we're still having to think very hard. We don't always know the answer, and there's a lot of it depends just because there's facts and circumstance tests. So if you want to know more and save more, like I'm looking at this one, how to legally write off your cell phone, that's pretty easy. On an accountable plan, you don't have to pay any tax on it. Like literally reimburse the whole thing, but it has to be an S-Corp or a C-Corp from a tax standpoint.
I reimburse my phone.
Yeah, got to do it. So go to AndersonAdvisors.com Facebook, AndersonAdvisors.com YouTube. And of course, if you have any questions, email them in, guys. No cost to it. Email it on in. We'll either have somebody answer it if it's really long and drawn out, or we'll get it back to you, or just visit Anderson Advisors. We probably have 200 videos on our site. And if you can't find the answer to your question there, by all means, become Platinum and just ask us and we'll get somebody right on it. Unlimited Q&A, it's whopping $35 a month. So if you want to find out more about that, just go to our website or email us in Tax Tuesday at Anderson Advisors. You talk to a lawyer, ask any tax question you want. It doesn't go up. It doesn't go down. It's been the same price for more than a decade. And we're not planning on raising it anytime. We have a really great group of folks. We have a great group of advisors. We got awesome clients all over the country. And, we're always thankful. So that's it, Jeff, unless you have anything.
No, I'm good to go. I'm glad you all could stay with us for today.
What's the coupon code again here? I'll just go back to that real quick. It's free tax, but you can grab that. And by all means, share that with kids before they go too crazy. Where am I located? We are in Las Vegas. We have offices, 3 offices here. We have offices in 45 states, as well as our main offices up in Tacoma, Washington. I and Jeff are sitting here in our Rainbow office in the second floor. We have 3 floors here. There's about 250 of us here, so don't tell them about the 2 animals. Oh, my God. You guys are crazy. Love it. Thanks, guys. Until next time, this is Toby and
Jeff.
Yep. Thanks again for spending some time with us on Tax Tuesday. Till next time.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. Show notes for links to everything mentioned in this episode can be found on our website at AndersonAdvisors.com/podcast. Be sure you subscribe to our podcast, and if you are already a subscriber, please provide us a review of what you thought of this episode.